Good day, everybody. I'm Admiral Jim Stavridis, and welcome to another episode of Navigating Leadership. We're here at the Navy Memorial in the heart of Washington, D.C. I'm about to interview one of the great admirals of our time, Admiral Lisa Franchetti. She was the first woman to be Chief of Naval Operations and the first woman to serve on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Come on inside. We're going to have a wonderful conversation together. Lisa, welcome.
It's great to see you, sir. Thank you for having me.
You bet. You're somebody I've known throughout almost all of your career. Of course, you were the 33rd Chief of Naval Operations. You were a destroyer captain, as was I. You were commander of Destroyer Squadron 21.
The Rampant Lions.
You were the Lion Queen. I was the Lion King. And I commanded them as well. And then you were 6th Fleet Commander in the Mediterranean. So an extraordinary career, Lisa. I'd like to talk about all of that, but I want to begin at the beginning. Why the Navy?
Well, first of all, it's great to see you again. Yeah. You've been an incredible mentor since I was a lieutenant commander. Yeah. And again, great to have a conversation with you today. You know, my beginning might be a little bit surprising, even to you.
Yeah, okay.
I went to Northwestern University. I was 17.
Yeah.
I was going to Medill,
the
most amazing journalism school in the country, and I was going to be a reporter. I was going to take Hebrew, Arabic, and be a reporter in the Middle East. But what happened is I was walking down campus during freshman orientation week, and I came across a bunch of guys playing football in a parking lot.
Okay.
And they had a cookout, and I stopped by, and I say hello, and I said, hey, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
And they said, oh, we're midshipmen. We are going to join the Navy and the Marine Corps one day. And I said, really? Tell me more. And they talked about they could get me $100 a month, free textbooks, and I might even be able to compete for a scholarship.
Amazing.
And they asked me to go in and talk to their lieutenant.
Yeah.
So I did. I went over to the unit and I sat down, talked with him. He was a pilot, A6 pilot, and he told me all kinds of amazing stories, sea stories as I now know them, about the Navy.
Yeah.
And I signed up on the spot.
Wow.
So I actually did get that scholarship a year later. So I always say, you know, I joined for free college, free textbooks, a chance to see the world, but I stayed for the mission, for the teams we get to lead and be a part of, and just a chance to serve something greater than myself.
I want to pull a thread out of that about leadership. That young lieutenant who's working there at the ROTC detachment, what did he say or do, or how did he kind of pull you toward the Navy, Lisa?
Oh my gosh, we had the best midshipman advisors there. In fact, one of them was then Lieutenant John Peterson, who eventually became Captain John Peterson, and he was a mentor throughout my time. You know, he talked a lot about Navy officers get responsibility fast. You get to go right out to sea, you get to lead a division. You know, at the time I was joining, there were not that many opportunities for women. In fact, only 17 women a year got to go to sea when I got commissioned in 1985. Wow. We had only been serving at sea since 1978, but he knew that there would be many more opportunities to come, and he was a great mentor, and he really just encouraged us to go out and learn all we could about being leaders and all we could about our folks once we got out there.
Now, if I'm correct about this, you went to sea for the first time as the coxswain of the crew team at Northwestern. That was your initial seagoing experience. I'm teasing you, of course, but tell me about fitness and how fitness matters for leaders.
Well, I would say, you know, being a coxswain at Northwestern, we were a club sport, so we're pretty scrappy. We had to do a lot of things ourselves. And I was actually a coxswain of the men's heavyweight boat.
Oh, my God.
So I learned a lot about leadership. You know, you have all these incredibly powerful individual athletes, but you need to get them to become part of the team, be part of the boat. And as a coxswain, it's your job to know them, to motivate each and every one of them.
I bet.
And, you know, what I learned through that is that hard work, perseverance, being fit, mentally fit, physically fit. You know, you can only be a great leader if you yourself are in your best condition. So taking care of yourself through fitness, you know, through mental and spiritual readiness, it's just critically important for all of our leaders.
Let me go back to your real first set of sea assignments. You go out on support ships because in those days, women did not serve in our frontline combatant destroyers. But then changes come along, and in the early 90s, those ships open up to women. So you're correct me if I'm wrong, one of the very first women to serve on a destroyer. Is that true?
That's true.
Yeah.
It's actually a really good luck and timing story. You know, I had done my sea tours. I had gone to shore duty. I was actually going to get out of the Navy because there was really no path for us to go to command without those combatant ships opening. And while I was at department head school, the law changed. So this is kind of in the fall of 1993.
Wow. Yep.
And again, good luck and timing, that matters sometimes. And myself, Mary Jackson, Cindy Tabo, we were all department heads in department head school or just recently reported. So we got to go to combatant ships as department heads. And I can tell you, it was a dream come true. Yeah. Ever since I was a midshipman, I had been hoping and writing lots of articles that I would just file away in folders about, hey, let's not ignore 50% of the population. Yeah. And you know, we need our best and brightest to get after our adversaries. And so getting to go to combatant was absolutely incredible. And it was a really different time. The way the Navy did it is they sent myself, a senior chief petty officer, and a second tour division officer. We went to the ship for about a month. We talked to the crew about what it was like to serve with women. Some of it was myth busting. Some of it was facts explaining. And then we got all 30 women reporting to our ship on one day. And our captain, he made it amazing. He was so excited to be able to integrate the crew and just make them a normal part of the team. And our ship did really well. So I'll tell you my amazing stories about this. This is the largest granite sea in the world. If you look out there, there's the Granite Sea.
Oh, right. And, Good point. Great point.
I got to commission the Washington Consortium of ROTC students here. And so we all stood out there on the Granite Sea for the commissioning.
I
and
love
it was
that.
Such a neat place to commission because you have the archives here.
Yeah.
So you're doing your commissioning right in front of the real Constitution.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So it was really an amazing thing
that
we had a chance to do.
I like the idea of doing it here.
Yeah, that's it
very
was good.
Cool. Yeah.
We also, President Carter, in his funeral, he also stopped right here.
I didn't know that.
And we had an entire brigade midshipmen here to salute him.
Oh, my
along
gosh.
With the superintendent of the Naval Academy.
Oh, that's so great.
Right here.
That's so great.
And this is where we do the concert on the Avenue.
That I knew.
So I hosted the concert on the Avenue. We brought 50 veterans from the Armed Forces Retirement Home here.
I love it.
And I got to dance with a World War II Marine.
That's
here.
A great story. So then you go on to command a destroyer yourself, USS Ross. What was your command tour like, and what's a leadership lesson you take out of that?
Yeah, my command tour was amazing. I think, you know, if anyone ever asks you what was your favorite tour, I think most people say whatever their first command tour. So Ross was mine. You know, you get to build your own team, about 300 people. We got to go on deployment. So I had all the amazing experiences as a young leader. You know, as I was heading into the tour, I wanted to do two things. One, I wanted to connect the crew of the Ross to our namesake, Donald Kirby Ross. He was a warrant officer, and he was on the USS Nevada in Pearl Harbor when the ships were attacked.
Right.
And he was just getting off duty, as the story goes. It was his birthday. He was getting ready to go out with his lovely date, who then became his wife. And then the ship was attacked. So he just sprang to action. He connected the steam plants between the two engine rooms. And Nevada is actually the ship that you see getting underway in those photos.
The only one
that got away. And so my lesson to the crew was, you always have to be ready. Yeah. You don't know when something's going to happen. I think the other part I wanted to do was, as a leader, I think people are sometimes afraid when they get a new leader. They're not sure what to expect. They don't know what they're going to be like. And so I thought I would tell them what mattered to me right up front so they knew exactly who they were dealing with. So I told them things that mattered were integrity, teamwork, people, warfighting excellence, safety always.
Let's go to your next stop. Now you're Commodore, and the Navy, of course, has a Commodore in charge, typically of about six ships. You and I share a command here. We both were Commodores of Destroyer Squadron 21, the Rampant Lions from World War II. When I made that jump from being a ship captain to being the Commodore in charge of half a dozen captains, that was a very profound leadership moment for me. It really opened my horizon. How did it work for you, Commodore?
Being a Commodore, that's a nonlinear transition. because you are supervising other leaders, yeah, other captains. Right. And it's a different thing to be able to mentor them, coach them, let them kind of learn their own mistakes,
yeah,
learn their own great things, yeah, and be there to support them through all of that, help them not fail, depending, yeah, on their personalities.
And there's a hard part of that, at least it was for me, which is that you're also required as the Commodore to rank them, to say, here are the two best, here are the two that are kind of in the middle, and here are the two that just aren't as strong. I found that very hard because I felt I was taking their careers into my hands. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, the most important thing I tried to emphasize is that they needed to work as a team. And you see this throughout your time in the Navy. Like, everyone is competing with each other for the next job. But as a leader, how do you get them to become a team, to bring all their strengths, everything that they can do to make you more successful, you and your team, yeah, more successful in the mission? And I always put my vote on the people who could play well in the sandbox more than the ones who were just the individual superstars.
I love your point about shaping them to work together as peers. It's a powerful one. Let me skip you ahead because it'll get us to a different kind of team. And I want to take you, now you're a 3-star admiral and you get what I think is possibly, for me it would have been the best job at the 3-star level in the Navy. You were the commander of the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean Sea. You had warships, you had sailors, you had Marines, but you also had a hat as a NATO commander in that time. So talk about how you translate as a leadership skill that kind of team building to the international sphere. What was that like?
Being the 6th Fleet commander was an amazing opportunity. Yeah. You know, you have ships operating in the Barents Sea, and we had Africa as well.
Right, of
course. So you have everything, all of your exercises, all of your operations all around Africa, Europe, all the way out into the middle of the Atlantic. And it was an incredibly busy time.
Yeah.
Russia was extremely busy during,
yeah,
my tour.
Yeah.
And it was a great opportunity, really, to bring the team together. But I was also the commander at the same time of NATO Striking and Support, right, Forces, which was headquartered over in Lisbon.
Correct.
So, you know, I found the same leadership tenets apply.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be present.
Mm-hmm.
So going over to Lisbon frequently,
yeah,
to be with them. And if I couldn't get over there to Lisbon, doing my VTCs,
right,
with them to be able to get updates from them. But it's really setting that strategic vision. What's our mission?
Mm-hmm.
Who we are? What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Where we're going? And how are we going to do that all together? I, mm-hmm, found that by being engaged, mm-hmm, with the leadership, mm-hmm, really relying on my deputy, Guy Robinson, a,
oh,
British,
yeah,
Royal Navy officer.
Mm-hmm.
He was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And really being part of that team.
Now, during your time, you had combat operations in Syria. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Tell us that story. What was that all about?
You, yes,
launched the first Tomahawk from a submarine, right?
John
into,
Warner.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
Tell that story.
Sure. So I actually had just reported. This all happened just about 6 weeks after I had taken command. And I was sitting on a Sunday having brunch,
yeah,
down on the Naples Harbor.
Oh, sure.
And I had an alert on my phone from Dataminer.
Oh, yeah.
That said, there was just an attack. Bandar al-Assad had launched chemical weapons on his own people. And I thought, oh no,
yeah,
this kind of be ready from,
yeah,
Ross. It came right back to,
right,
me. So I called my ops officer. I was like, let's get in, let's meet. Something's going to happen. We start to need to come up with options. So,
yeah,
you know, fast forward a week later. By then, we had put together with Amalak Lino, who, mm-hmm, was the 5th Fleet commander.
Oh, that's right.
A multi-axis, multi-domain strike. And again, it's another example of the fact that you can't surge trust. We,
yeah,
already had relationships with our French counterparts, our British counterparts, and being able to put together a really tight, coherent plan,
yeah,
to be able to basically get all weapons on target at the same time.
Yeah.
And of course, we were complying with, you know, the end state of our civilian leadership, which is minimal or no casualties,
mm,
get rid of the chemical weapons manufacturing,
right,
capability and knock all of that out.
Right.
So it was really a, you know, a really good moment,
yeah,
for 6th Fleet to be,
yeah,
able to do that,
yeah,
and deliver that along with our,
yeah,
our sister fleet.
So this combat operation occurs, then you move on and take a couple jobs in the meantime. Then you become our 33rd Chief of Naval Operations. So you're in charge of hundreds of thousands of sailors, train, equip, and organize. Member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of course, during very tumultuous times. What did you take into that job as CNO?
Well, I would say the first one would be integrity.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is the foundation of trust in every single organization. So, you know, I, as a leader, always wanted people to know that I would always do the right thing.
Whether
someone was looking or not, and that, you know, I would always support them and that I would count on them to be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the other one was goes back to this teamwork. It even goes back to being a coxswain of a boat.
Sure.
You know, as you know, all the four stars have a lot of different ideas, and I had a lot of different ideas as the CNO. But I felt like my job was really to kind of bring together all of our leaders to have a unifying vision of the Navy, back to the who we are, what we do, where we're going. Right. You know, I really wanted to focus on warfighting, warfighters, and then building up that foundation that supports both of those things. And so what I realized is that bringing all of our leaders together, both the four-star leaders, the three-star leaders, all of our senior enlisted leaders, kind of walking them through my mind map of how did I see this unfolding as a Navy over the next 4 years, and getting them to invest in it with their own ideas, sharpening it, made it a much better strategy, a much better approach. So that team building, having buy-in, you have all of these people that are out all around the world, because you know we're a globally dispersed organization, 600,000 people. To get everybody on the same page, I really needed that teamwork, that investment from them. So I think teamwork is another really good one.
You said something a minute ago that you can't surge trust. And I really think that's profoundly correct. You have to build that over years. I don't know if you got into it as CNO, the diving and salvage kind of work.
I never touched this. In fact, I actually got to go down to, which is now a joint diving school,
Panama
EOD
City.
School in Panama City. I got to see how we train the divers now. Yeah. And in fact, it was the day that they were basically putting on the modern version of that suit and putting the divers over the side to go down for their first time in a pressurized suit. So it was a really interesting experience. And it was all joint.
Yeah.
And we had a bunch of students there from Peru.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I, in a different parallel universe, I think being CNO would have been almost as good as being Supreme Allied Commander.
Being a CNO is the best.
Yeah, no, that's what I would expect you to say. Lisa, what do you think of this? The National Chiefs Mess. How cool is that?
It's really cool. You know, it brings back a lot of memories. On my first ship, I had two chiefs, Chief Satriano and Salvatore, and then I was Frank Hetty, so we had the Italian chiefs. And, you know, as a young officer, I learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
And I carried that with me throughout my career.
Yeah, I think every naval officer can think back on the chief that he or she first learned from. Who are some of your other mentors that spring to mind when you think about people who influence your career?
You know, there are so many mentors, and I've been really fortunate to have a lot of them. You know, I would say, you know, General Scaparotti was an incredible mentor. I actually got to work for him or with him twice. He was the commander of U.S. forces in Korea when I was the commander of naval forces in Korea.
Yeah.
And as the only naval officer on the entire, naval flag officer on the entire peninsula, you could feel a little bit left out, but he made sure that I was not left out. Yeah. I was included in all of the general officer meetings, all the planning for the peninsula.
Yeah.
We had a monthly meeting where I actually got to teach him a little bit about anti-submarine warfare, and he taught me a lot about leadership and being part of the team. I would say, you know, beyond the Navy and Marine Corps and Army leadership that I work with closely like that, I would say two other inspirational figures, you know, Madeleine Albright, you know, our Secretary of State, you know, American success story from being a refugee to being a Secretary of State. Yep. And, you know, She was the Secretary of State when I was just leaving my department head tours, really understanding the broader role that the Navy could play beyond just the military, how we enable diplomacy, how we support economic security, and just watching how she built coalitions, put together a Cold War roadmap, you know, wore some pins that sometimes signaled things in her silent diplomacy. It was very interesting to watch her as a young leader.
I couldn't agree with you more. I knew her very well. I would add to everything you said, great sense of humor. She could crack up a room. Do you have another?
I think the last, you know, as I was thinking about different leaders, you know, James Stockdale, you know, you think about reaching deep in because you have confidence in, you know, your beliefs, your values. I've always followed a quote that I kind of paraphrase from Admiral Nimitz, which goes, learn all you can, do your best, and don't worry about what you can't control. Because all you can really control is your level of effort, your curiosity, you know, the outcomes that you can produce. And there will always be stuff going on that you can't control. But in the end, do what you can, and you're always going to be your best you.
And that's what great leaders do. And you, Admiral Lisa Franchetti, are a great leader. Thanks for spending time with me.
Thank you. CNN. Such an honor to see you.
My honor. Thank you.